Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha. Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. This September 15, 2015 edition, episode 55 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from a few locations. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. And you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week we have a statement from Guy as well as some thoughts on last week's show, plus an interview with Chris Shaw. Today we will be taking calls for our guest at 888-874-4888. But we start, as we often have lately with recent shows, with some words from the good doctor. Guy?
I'm going to mention this a little later as well in place of a climate change update. During last week's show, Dave from Chicago called in with a request. He wanted a short paragraph he could memorize that would tell people about abrupt climate change, because when you try to talk about it, generally they think you're a little crazy. So here's my initial effort, and as always, I welcome your feedback. We are in the midst of abrupt climate change, which will soon obliterate habitat on this planet for our species. This event has precedence in Earth's history, and it's irreversible at time frames that matter for humans. Civilization is a heat engine, and the planet is about to overheat. Our species, like all others, will go extinct. It's later than you think. I'm not suggesting we give up in the face of certain death. I am, however, indicating that birth is a sexually transmitted disease that is lethal in every case. We all die. What matters now is how we choose to live. That's always been the case, although we often lose track of the urgency as we go about our daily lives. With that, we're joined today by Dr. Christopher Shaw. Chris is visiting fellow in the field of science and policy research at the University of Sussex in the UK. He is interested in building a more participatory process for deliberating on climate policy. Chris Shaw is a researcher with more than 10 years' experience in researching and writing about the communication of climate change. Chris is the Climate Outreach and Information Network's newest member of staff. He joined the team in July 2015. You can follow his work with that organization at climateoutreach.org.uk. Prior to that, Chris worked for 2 years at the University of Oxford's Environmental Change Institute, where he successfully led interdisciplinary projects exploring the role of the public in the delivery of climate policy goals. Chris received his PhD in 2011 from the School of Law, Politics, and Sociology at the University of Sussex in the UK. His dissertation is titled, Choosing a Dangerous Limit for Climate Change, How the Decision-Making Process is Constructed in Political Discourses. Chris writes on climate change for several publications and is the climate change columnist for the new magazine, SALT, at wearesalt.org. He recently received an award from the International Association for Media and Communication Research. That's at iamcr.org. That was for a climate outreach website currently in development. Chris is a visiting research fellow at the Science and Policy Research Institute at the University of Sussex. His forthcoming book is titled The 2 Degrees Dangerous Limit for Climate Change, Public Understanding and Decision-Making. Congratulations on the book, Chris Shaw, which will be published next month, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Guy. Thanks for this chance to join you and your listeners, and real privilege to be part of what is a very important project you're involved in, so thank you very much for this chance.
Sure, it's our pleasure. Before we really get started, I'd like to ask a little bit more information about you and your path. You're an expert on the topic of decision-making and the public discourse behind it. How did you arrive at this topic as your area of expertise?
It started in 2003, because in Europe, in 2003, there was a heat wave which claimed about 50,000, or about 30,000 lives across the continent of Europe and the UK. And I guess prior to that, I've been a bit sensitized to environmental issues. I mean, I grew up, I sort of came of age at the time when Margaret Thatcher came to power. There was a big shift in the political makeup of the country, the political climate. And, you know, I just came into adulthood and I thought, this isn't my world. I really couldn't connect. But I also had this sort of deep-rooted sort of connection with the environment, and that had been building and developing in various ways. And then around about 1990, climate change came into the news, and I thought, okay, you know, well, I guess what I was, it wasn't about sort of saving the planet per se, but it was about, well, okay, look, you know, if this is for real, then we can't carry on with this, you know, capitalist system, neoliberal system, which I found so abhorrent anyway. So for me, as a rebel looking for a cause, climate change was it. So, you know, I was pretty much pre-sensitized to those signals of a warming planet, that sense that the way humans were acting through those industrial processes were an act of war against nature, etc., etc., something I'm sure you and your listeners are all very familiar with. So anyway, so by the time 2003 came along, you know, I was sort of worried about climate change anyway, and then as this huge heat wave hit the country and hit continental Europe, I was a father of two young children. And I was aware enough of what was going on to know that there was this idea that already the politicians were talking about, well, 2 degrees is a dangerous limit. As long as the planet doesn't warm by more than 2 degrees, you know, everything's going to be fine. So that's what we're going to do. Just make sure the planet doesn't warm by more than 2 degrees. Now, in 2003, the planet warmed an average of 0.7 degrees at that point. This heat wave hit. And I was like, well, hold up, you know, this killed 30,000 people, described as the biggest natural disaster ever to hit Europe. We're not even halfway to this dangerous limit. You know, and there's a pair of young children seeing the media weren't really, you know, they were just celebrating these temperatures, like, oh, you know, urging the thermometer ever higher, especially in the UK, where we have pretty dismal summers normally. This was like, you know, wonderful thing. And you've got, and all the campaigners, the NGOs are just silent on this. I was like, well, this is happening now. You know, this 2 degree thing is a death sentence. So that really was, for me, was a father of young children. I was like, right, you know, I was working in the depths of the corporate world at that time, looking for a way out. And so I sort of, what I did is I set up a group called Their Future. I thought, okay, parents of young children like me are all going to be worried about what's going on, looking at their children in the future, realizing it's screwed. And, you know, so this would be like a vanguard movement. Let's get, you know, activate that emotional concern, that protective concern people have for their children, and let's really push this on. Now, I was a bit naive in that, you know, obviously the revolutionary army of young of parents of young children hasn't emerged. But through that process, a friend of mine said, oh, you know, why don't you go back to university, do a master's, and you'll understand better how to sort of research audiences and engage them. I said, okay, let's do that. So I did that. Left my job. My wife kindly said, well, I'll go back to work full time. You do. I know this is something you really want to do. So fantastic. And then that turned into a PhD. So that's really where it all started. Like, this 2 degree thing stinks. This, you know, I smell a rat here. And what's at stake? Nothing very minor. The future of humanity, the well-being of my children, future generations, this generation. And that is really the path I've been on since, 2005, something like that.
Wow. And, you know, I agree completely with you about the 2C target. It's ludicrous, and it sort of reminds me of the year 2100. Nothing, if you believe the mainstream media, or for that matter, a whole bunch of climate scientists, nothing bad happens to the planet, to our species, until 2100, apparently on January 1st. And the same with 2C. It all goes along just fine at 2C. Never mind the weather-related catastrophes undoubtedly driven by climate change that we're seeing already.
Quite. So what's it all about? That's what I wanted to find out. Why are they doing this, you know? And why are NGOs, why are the campaigners, why are the friends of the people all jumping on this 2-degree bandwagon? You know, so, they're the ones who, you know, they are the vanguard. They're the ones who are going to be standing up to this. And all of them, as radical as you can find, are all saying 2C, that solves climate change. As long as we don't go above that, we have solved climate change. We've fought climate change. We've combated climate change. And, you know, the bright new future awaits us beyond the 2-degree world.
Right. Right. Never mind that the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases warned in October 1990, beyond 1 degree C may elicit rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. That was 25 years ago, and it's the United Nations, a pretty conservative organization, pointing out that we cannot go beyond 1C. Well, by some accounts, we're already beyond 1C. Can you tell us how and why 2C was selected as a political target?
Yeah, so, and it came from, you know, well, go figure, institutions populated by wealthy, white, generally Europeans and Americans, but it came from Europe, it came from, really, there was, in the early 90s, a German Advisory Council on Global Change, which in German, I can't pronounce it in German, but the initials are WBGU, and they produced a report in, let me just remember these dates, 1995, 1997, and 2003. And here's the real kicker. So they said, okay, what we need to do is find... So obviously the two-degree thing had been going around. It started about 1977, I think, a Nordhaus paper, or 1979, had said 2 degrees. But he was an economist, so he says, you know, looking at it from an economist's perspective, the damage of 2 degrees is a price worth paying for, you know, replicating the system we've got at the moment. So there, it was kicking around. And in terms of formalizing it, it emerged within Europe, around Germany, this group, WBGU, which was a sort of policy science type interface institution. And what they did is said, we've got to sort of work out what the target is and work back from there, how we're going to get there, the targets, what we need to cut, et cetera, et cetera. And what they did in that original paper was they said, now... they decided that the dangerous limit, looking back at the pre-industrial average, was 1.6 degrees above the pre-industrial average, was when dangerous climate change would hit. And that could be debated. But because we, humans now, are better able to cope with the risks, the disruptions, the impacts of climate change than our hunter-gatherer forebears were, we can actually add a 0.5 degree onto that, and we get to 2 degrees. Now, I don't know how you make that calculation and how you assume that people today would be better able to cope with the, you know, the collapse of the supermarket food distribution systems, etc. I don't know, but you know, that was one of it. And, you know, there's the other thing. This happened around, so I said, I think this was 1995, that first one, then 1997, 2003. You know, you're in sort of, we're modernity, post-modernity. How do we cope with environmental problems in this day and age? We set a limit. We find a safe limit, and then we work to that. Now, what those safe limits are, always, they're not a constraint on industrial activity. They're never a constraint on that dangerous activity. They're never a constraint on that risk activity. They're a displacement of that risk onto others, poorer, weaker people. And they are actually an enabling framework. They allow the activity to continue. And I can give you a couple of really good examples of that to prove the point. And I'm not going to, as much as I can't pronounce the name of that German organization, but there was a can't pronounce the name of the volcano in Iceland a few years ago that erupted and brought air travel in Europe to a halt. And the reason it brought air travel to a halt was because there was no safe limit for ash concentrations in the atmosphere. All ash in the atmosphere was dangerous to airplanes, so all airplanes had to be grounded. And so what the airplane industries, airport industries lobbied for was to set a safe limit. And once the safe limit was set, and it was set above what the concentration was, planes could fly again. Now, you could say, actually, well, the planes didn't crash, you know, the ash didn't cause them to come to the ground. But that's not the point. It's to illustrate that what limits do is enable the activity to continue. They're not to stop the activity. They're not to limit the activity, despite, you know, the use of the word limit. They are to enable. And the other example is Fukushima. And again, after the tsunami and the Fukushima disaster, radiation limits went way above what they're allowed in the food, in the soil, in the playgrounds of the school. So kids weren't going to the school. So what did the schools, what did the system, what did the institutions lobby for so that the system could continue? An increase in the safe radiation levels in the soils, in schools, so that kids could go back to school. And so again, you know, there's an input. So the science is shoddy, if there's any science around it. And then, you know, talking about the 2 degrees, but there's a great deal of desire to set a limit because then you can just kick the can down the road, make it a problem for the future when the 2 degree limit arises or when those concentrations that we're adding to the atmosphere look like we're getting to those limits that equate to 2 degrees. Then you've got to solve it. But in the meantime, it makes it a problem further down the road so we can carry on as we are. So I think all of those things fed into an acceptance, an easy acceptance by the politicians in Germany of this 2 degree idea. And then that was really picked up and ran with by a range of other governments for the reasons I've just outlined.
You're listening to Dr. Chris Shaw. Chris is a visiting fellow in the field of science and policy research at the University of Sussex. So, Chris, it sounds to me like the limits are just a way to kind of keep the narrative going, really. I mean, kind of keep the story going.
That's right. So they are. So, you know, climate change is what they say. If you have a global limit, what do you say? You say, right, so this is a global problem. To understand a global limit, we need to know how much carbon is in the atmosphere. Well, we measure that in parts per million. So what do we need? We need satellites. We need a global network of measuring stations. We need laboratories. We need these big institutions. You know, so what does climate change become? Climate change then is no longer a problem of modernity. It is at this point, through that global framing, it becomes a problem solvable only by modernity. So again, this global framing through these very, you know, parts per million, this exact numbers, this quantification, enables, it legitimizes, because when I first, you know, as I said, you know, when I saw climate change came along, that's it. Well, that's game up for capitalism. I wasn't aware of the same, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And you could, you know, sort of interrogate the term capitalism. But, I just thought, well, no one would want to carry on and destroy what we've got for the sake of what? Economic growth. You know, who's benefit from that? Absolutely. My understanding of that limit discourse is it's a political act. It's not a scientific fact. It's an act, a framing, a language which serves, is designed to legitimate business as usual, the reproduction of existing sort of industrial practices and social practices in the face of the undeniable knowledge that those very practices are what is driving this terminal event.
Absolutely. It seems to me that we've replaced life with capitalism, with the economy. We're going to take a caller, Matt from Florida. Do you have a question?
Hello, am I on the air?
You are on the air.
Well, hi, and thank you for taking my call. I actually run a near-term human extinction support group and can be found on meetup.com, and I am looking for a venue for the 22nd of this month, Tuesday night here in Boulder, Colorado, to talk to people about near-term human extinction and to further the cause of being a benefit to all living beings so that they may have a good life and experience a death in peace. Now, this discussion that you've brought up and your title as being a professor and PhD of climate communication, is that a fair assessment? Did I get that introduction by Guy correctly?
Well, I would say, I've worked in the area of climate communication. I'm not overly happy, you know, I guess for a while I was, flattered by this. So I'm a doctor, you know, but I've done work in climate communications, but I'm not a doctor of anything really, you know. But anyway, please do go on, Matt.
Well, Chris, I hear your wisdom, and it's coming through your presentation, and I've listened carefully to Guy's wisdom as well, too. And in the end, there's something missing. This process of communicating this issue has failed, you know, profoundly. It has failed at a level of failure that can be only described as the greatest failure of humanity in the course of its history. And the fact that I'm talking to someone who has experienced this on both sides, I saw your website. It looks like you've got a pretty formidable communication machine there, but yet we've had absolutely no effective changes in policy that are meaningful at any point. And this trouble that the progressive community has had when they've tried to tackle capitalism, when they've tried to tackle abortion, when they've tried to tackle practically any sort of social issue at all, has just been failure met with failure met with failure. And the question I'm asking you, under the assumption that you are the highest level of expert on communication I've ever talked to on this, since we've all failed at this, since we've completely failed at telling people what they need to know to make policy decisions, then maybe the process isn't media-based. Maybe it's not information-based. Maybe there's a second process. What do you think?
Yeah, Matt, that is spot on question, and it's really been uppermost in my mind, and I'm really grateful. It's almost like it's a plug for me to go on to my next part. So thanks, Matt. Yeah. So I'll tell you what I've been doing just recently in my recent, over the past couple of weeks, I've been running some workshops in the UK with members of the public, and we'd say, so you may be aware, I'm sure the listeners here are probably aware, that there's a global conference come up in Paris at the end of the year to try and agree, get an agreement that the warming will be limited to 2 degrees centigrade. And it's a build on Copenhagen. And so in theory, all the world leaders, or many of the world's leaders, will be there. So, so you hear people say, well, climate change is the biggest challenge ever faced humanity. And, it's everyone's problem. We've all got me involved in it. So, I've gone out to these people. We've been holding these groups. We have a talk, what matters to you, what's important, da, da, da. Then we move on to climate change. Right, so this is in the UK, which I think has got that still remains. We've got the most ambitious legally binding targets in the world of 80% by 2050. So a world leader in principle on climate change. I go out to ask people. I said, "So what do you think of climate change?" Some of those people say, "What? What's climate change?" Others, this is just the public. Okay, so this is not you and me, and we're on board. We know what's going on. This is just out there. Okay, and then. And then even though I talk to people who really turned on and say, what do you think about, about climate change, you're worried about it. What do you think about this talk coming up at the end of the year? The most important event, the biggest names in the world, the world leaders there talking about it, all of them. What do you think about it? Never heard of it. Don't know what you're on about. Okay, so absolutely right, Matt. This comes, so I really just, I'm come to realize that I thought that and I've been speaking to some government people, and they say, do you know what? Most people in the government don't know what's going on. And I thought, okay, now this is, so we're doing this research and saying, well, we're going to tell the government, all your efforts to tell people about climate change are totally failing. No one knows what you're on about. No one cares. You think the world's watching you. No one cares at all what you're doing. Okay, so... And then I thought, hold on, maybe that's no accident. Maybe this whole frame, because when we speak to people, it's like, 2 degrees and this global, that's too complex for me. Now, I can't understand why that would be complex. Because, it seems to me the simplest thing, it's like driving too fast, smoking too many cigarettes, whatever. You do too much of something, it goes bad, But apparently that's just too complex for the public. So you're absolutely right. Communications have failed. The organisation I'm with, so you're right, and there's no easy answers. Now, what lies at the core of the organisation I'm working with at the moment is a really, really strong principle, which is no one's talking about climate change amongst the public. We're like 1%, 0.5% of the world's population who talk about climate change, even know what's going on. I speak to members of the public, I thought that was all over now. So what happens when there's that void, when no one is talking about climate change, what happens? It gets occupied, that space, that lack of public conversation gets occupied, colonized by the corporations, by the skeptics, by the sort of neoliberals, and the ground remains theirs for the debate, and all other alternative perspectives are excluded. And that's a real problem. And the media are not, obviously, have failed, using the media to communicate has failed. What this organization is trying to do, when we have these conversations, we sit down with about 10 people and you talk, So what matters to you as a human? You know, what are the things you care about? What are good human values? And what they come out, all these people come out with: kindness, caring, respect, honesty, integrity. I'm not saying they all live in, you know, none of us are saints, but there's this sense, and Noam Chomsky writes about this, that we all think we're mad for thinking that those are the values that count. You know, actually the values that count are getting as much as I can for myself, getting on as much as I can, looking after me and my own. And we talk to people like, no, this isn't what it's about. The problem is, Matt, you know, how can you reach millions and millions of people doing that with little small conversations? You know, and they come away thinking, well, I want to know more about climate change. I want to understand what's going on. So you're absolutely right that you know, it has failed and it will continue to fail all the time, that solving climate change is constructed as limiting it to 2 degrees and leaving it to experts, world leaders and these international conferences as the means by which humanity will be solved. It has failed, it will continue to fail, and until, you know, that whole 2 degree framing of please save me, President Obama, please save me, Mr. Cameron, till all that nonsense is gone and we rise up, recognise and reclaim our own nobility, our own sovereignty and our own ability to act in the best interests of humanity, then we are doomed. So I fully agree, Matt, and there's no, you know, but what else can you, I can't not do anything. I'm not saying it's going to work, but to walk away from it and not try is not an option for me. So I'm going to keep going and doing whatever I can. But yeah, you know, it has failed, you're quite right.
Thank you for the call, Matthew. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Guy McPherson. Mike Spleva and I are joined today by Chris Shaw from the UK. Chris, you brought up something really important there, and that's that at least a significant portion of the citizenry is in the dark about this issue. So with respect to the 2C target, what does the citizenry know and what do they think about this target? Do you have some feel for that? And as you're answering this, I'll remind listeners that we're taking calls at
888-874-4888.
So Chris,
okay,
what does the citizenry know?
Yeah, so from the research we've done today, so there was another 2013, an organization called Carbon Brief in the UK did a survey of, I think they did an online survey of about 1,000 people in the UK, and they asked them, what do you think is a dangerous limit? What do you think governments have defined as a dangerous limit? And I think about 80% of the replies were don't know. The next biggest answer was 10 degrees C. Then I think it was 5 degrees C, and then there was a few, the people who said 2 degrees C were guessing, I guess, you know. So some of them got it right because they because they had, you know, a range from 0 to 10 degrees, and so some people, you know, are guessing about to hit 2 degrees. So there is no awareness out there of the 2 degree thing, of what it is, you know. When people see these wind turbines or see, you know, debates about energy switches and all these other debates, there's no real connection of to what, why this is happening, what it is that those initiatives are trying to avoid, what bad impacts are trying to be averted. So at the moment, the public are, as far as I can make out, completely adrift of this 2 degree narrative, which is, you know, what exercises, motivates and takes up the time of the the world leaders, the campaigners, the experts, the academics. You know, they're all talking to themselves and wondering about how to, you know, what the people think about 2 degrees. They don't think anything about it.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Matt has a follow-up question. Go ahead, Matt. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Matt.
Okay, great. Chrissy, and I've talked to Guy and others on this thing. There's this issue about capitalism in general, and then there's this thing called capitalism media. You know, what that crossover means, that information is money, and reach is money. So when I talked to Guy initially about this, we need about 100 million. And Chris, if I wrote you a check right now for $100 million and said, you need to get this message out to every human being on Earth in a way that they can affect policy, could you do it? Could you use the capitalist communication system efficiently, effectively, and get the message out? This is where the separation between capitalism and non-capitalism becomes the big problem when you're talking about information. You're talking about access to certain markets and certain, this just costs money. And, you know, what I wanted to do was to set up what is essentially a key focal point of funding so that we could access the capitalist media system and get this message out effectively across all channels. And that, my friends, is a capitalist challenge. This is a let's get a pile of money and make something happen challenge. And I think the progressives in general are uncomfortable with this. And in specific, it sounds to me, Chris, that you've not been a big fan of capitalism. And the list of, you know, good things about it is short in my book as well. But right now, we are really facing the only solution is going to be through capitalist media systems. I don't think that Guy's radio show here and me doing my meetup support groups is quite going to do it. So we're going to need to have, like, a huge influx of media-based money. Any thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, again, thanks for that very prescient and insightful question. Yeah, because obviously any media message will be sitting alongside adverts for flights to some exotic location that are employing sophisticated marketing techniques and psychological techniques. And that feeds into sort of sense of what the good life is and what I deserve and what, you know, I've earned my money, what am I going to spend it on? So it's always going to compete. What the model that Coin are trying to use, but, you know, reach a mass audience is going to be difficult, but it's saying, like, you know, within any community or group of people, there'll be someone who's a trusted messenger within there, you know, and it's sort of, unless it comes from that trusted messenger, then it's probably just gonna be water off a duck's back. So this media, I mean, I could send you, Matt, you know, from just this year alone, I probably could send you 500 links to stories about 2 degrees in Paris that have been in the media, and still there'd be no you know, they would not be connecting with people because it's just the way it's framed. It seems technical. It's normally associated with graphs, etc. Or it might only be appearing in certain sections of the media. And so there is this problem that, you know, the researchers have identified called the information deficit model. So, you know, you have people, you know, we're all rational actors. And what we're just waiting for is someone to fill us up with the right information. And then we will act in the correct way.
Is that true? Is that true, though, or is that theory?
The research seems to indicate that idea of how humans operate as this rational actor who just wants the right information, you know, like a computer just needs good data in and you'll get good data out, is false, because we're emotional creatures, we're inconsistent creatures, and we, you know, there's a range of influences on how we behave, a range of constraints, structural constraints. People today are very concerned about their jobs, about their status, about their income, so they'll commute whatever distance, you know, to keep their job or get the job, do whatever, you know, they'll not say this, not say that in order to keep their job. I mean, and again, you know, this is some pressure I sort of sense even in my work, you know, I'm just reading a lot of stuff at the moment, you know, it's time to be honest, it's time to be honest with people, but then that honesty is associated with discourses of 2 degrees solves climate change, we're going to fight, battle, and defeat climate change or whatever. But actually, you know, the honestly, there's like a sense of, well, you know, if you talk about it in terms of, you know, good jobs, creating good jobs, and all these co-benefits that come from fighting climate change, and it just feels a bit, you know, delusional and dishonest to say, well, the only way you're going to get people on board with this is to tone down the doom and gloom messages and to really pump up, you know, all the positives. Then you'll get people on board. And the other point you raise there, Matt, is the issue of, you know, then could you do this in such a way that people could sort of act? And the other thing is that, you know, I've seen this communication stuff is that, you know, the right communications will encourage people to take action. What that action is generally remains undefined. And I think what it is that we can do as individuals, and again, when you do the research, people say, you know, actually people aren't stupid, but they say, well, look, you know, I mean, I think there's two elements here. They say, look, this is, those recognize, say, this is a huge problem. This is for business, governments, and large institutions to address. What can I do? You know, I can rinse out a pot, you know, and my sink and recycle it. But, you know, all at the same time, you know, they're drilling for oil in Alaska. So, you know, and then also when you do the research, you know, again, people say, well, you know, you look at it and they'll say, yeah, people want, right, this is in the UK and Europe, well, we want green energy, we want more renewables, we want X, Y, and Z. The government don't do it. People shrug their shoulders and say, well, sorry, what am I meant to do? You know, I've told you what I want you to do. You're not going to do it. I can't do it. I can't build a wind farm or whatever it might be. So I think there's a range of issues there, Matt, that even just chucking millions at a media machine, it's like when they do, you know, when they go and they decide they're going to go and kill some more poor people in whatever Middle Eastern country it might be, there will be a media campaign to justify it, you know, so to sort of limit resistance. But they don't then go and say, and now we expect you to go and melt down your shovels and your cutlery, make a weapon, a bayonet, a sword or whatever, and join us and go out and fight there. You know, so, but that's sort of what's happening with climate change. It's like, well, this is all that, and you've got to go and solve it, you know. And so
well,
I think
you're talking about.
Have we lost Matt there?
I think we have.
So I hope it didn't come back. But so the other thing I think that is very difficult, which is sort of just trying to lead on from what Matt was saying, is, you know, in terms of communication, media, etc., is what do you if you don't, there's no story to say about climate change unless you've got a dangerous limit at the end of it. Then you've got, like, you know, then you've got your classic storyline. You've got, once upon a time there was a happy land where everyone was shopping and working, and there was joy amongst the land, as people went on eBay and Amazon and spent their hard-earned money, and all was good. And then along came this monster, you know, of climate change, and it threatened to wreak havoc on the land and bring misery. But then the good night of sort of green energy, eco-modernism, etc., arose and slayed this monster, brought forth this world of new, clean, green energy technologies, and all was well in the land again, and people returned to the activities that they knew. And, you know, and that, you know, this sort of thesis, you know, what is happening now, that the setup, antithesis, the problem, and then the synthesis, the resolution of the problem in the new order. That's the classic storyline that humanity has grown up with, and we've all, you know, all the fairy tales from childhood, all the films, they all have this same basic structure. And the climate change story has that, but it's false. Again, you know, it's this sense that we will solve climate change and everything will be as it was once again in the future. It's just we won't have the nasty emissions. So, you know, it's a, what stories replace that? What structure replaces that when actually, you know, there is no end to the story, when there is no knight on the in shining armor coming to rescue us all? Then what stories do we tell? What stories do we tell without the 2-degree target? And this is what I've found when I've tried to research this, when I've tried to, you know, publish and get people, you know, and others have done this as well more recently about, you know, this 2-degree target stinks, we've got to, you know, get rid of it. No one wants to know because no one's got anything else in the bag. You know, there's nowhere to go. It's this global, so some people talk about 1.5 degrees or whatever, but that framing is the only game in town. So to try and challenge that is to challenge the very basic power structures of modernity, neoliberalism, the means by which this destructive system legitimates and replicates itself. So it's a hard sell.
Okay, great. We have Rick from Ohio, and he has a question. Rick, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking the call, bro. Well, I'm kind of out in left field somewhere because, you know, I am concerned as you all are, but ultimately, it is as if we have been all rewired to understand things differently. You know, I have a basic philosophy. And my philosophy is that nothing has ever been broken as proof that anything is true. So regardless of what you perceive, nothing can be broken that you perceive it. And so that is why I think the planet melts. Is because, you know, it is okay to disagree. It is okay to hate. I hate. But I cannot spill a cup of water that I perceive it. I should take a more prosecutorial approach and put a case together that I see it. Do you see?
Yeah, I think I do. Can you just explain more how that relates to sort of the climate change thing? Because I'm not certain I've quite understood your philosophy, which is my failing, not your philosophy's failing. But if you could just give me sort of an example or something, hopefully I can sort of think it through in terms of, you know, the stuff I know.
Let's say racism, you know?
Yeah.
What we perceive as racism, I say it isn't. You know, lynching and all of that, that's not proof of race. Because there's no proof. You're simply splintering labor for not accepting the claim. That's why it's melting here. Nothing can be broken as proof that anything is true. You can't break a toothpick that you perceive anything. It's impossible. But we have been rewired to see it differently. Someone walks into a coffee house and guns down everyone with unibrow and says he hates everyone with unibrow, we would think he is telling the truth, but there's no proof. He's simply splintering society. And so and the consequence of that is not climate change, but global warming. That's why it's happening. That's why the walrus is coming ashore. It's because we think we can break things as proof that we perceive. And we believe others who actually attempted. The woman who wouldn't give out marriage licenses that has nothing to do with homophobia is the world's oldest profession. You can't prove you're homophobic. You can only spend to society for not accepting it. it's laughable, but no one calls her on it. That's why the planet melts, bro. That's what I see. So I can't sit down with 10 people and say what I think is real or whatever. It just doesn't happen here. But that is what I would say. You know, I love my neighbor, and there is proof. You know, but if I want to tell my neighbor that the planet melts, I can't throw a brick through his window. Because that has nothing to do with it. It's simply an inflationary act for not accepting the claim.
I'm going to use...
I just wanted to say it, man. I appreciate the call, and thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
I'm going to use Rick's comment and question to transition a little bit. The implications of the 2C limit... what are they for framing democratic governance? You know, we've been sold this story, this narrative, which is a lot like the bigger story we've been sold, that of civilization or capitalism. What are the implications for democratic governance, and how do we move towards democratic governance in light of this story, in light of this narrative?
Yeah, thank you. And I think, again, that's, and it leads on nicely from Rick's point, I think, with, you know, with a sense of, you know, that 2 degrees is dangerous for everyone. You know, that's a truth and we can all agree it. And I think this then, and that's a nice transition, because I think there's an intrinsic limit, and perhaps some of these sort of, you know, one world order people, you know, I think there's a core of truth there. Obviously, the larger the political structure, inevitably the less responsive it's going to be to the people who are, you're part of that. So, you know, so the climate change is constructed as a global problem. And, you know, what is the evidence? So someone, Andrew Sterling, professor at the University of Sussex, made the very prescient point a little while ago. When in the history of humanity, has everyone all agreed on what needs to be done? Never. And so it's not going to happen with climate change. And yet, nonetheless, this idea of one dangerous limit for all humanity, which we can all, you know, agree on, get a shoulder to the wheel on, unite around as one, you know, huge, harmonious global family, and work to achieve. That's the sort of message we're hearing from, you know, the campaign organizations and from governments and from these international leaders. So how do we, and so that is essentially undemocratic, because this, and so in the end, you know, science might be able to say, well, you know, certain things will happen or are likely to happen when the planet reach, you know, when warming reaches X, Y, and Z levels. But in terms of scientists can't say, but that level is too much. That's not a scientific judgment. That is a value choice. That is a subjective value choice. It varies according to what an individual values, what they want, it varies according to, you know, how resilient their community is, what sort, you know, they may be living in a floodplain, they may be very poor, they may be very susceptible to climate change impacts. There's a range of variabilities in the global system, in human experience, in human societies, which deny any claim for a single dangerous limit. So that claim made by democratic governments, marginalizing the people of those countries and from of the world from the debate, is very undemocratic. So how do we move from there? Well, you know, I think climate change is the terminus of globalization, the terminus of that project of building this, you know, one world. I think one of the dangerous messages that came around the same time that environmentalism came on the scene was this idea of the global village, you know, and you had people say, well, the image of the Earth taken by from space around about the late 60s really brought, you know, sort of the fragile planet, fragile island of life in this sea of darkness was what really initiated the environmental movement. Well, if it's true, then from its very inception, it's been flawed and doomed, because I think that global that idea that I'm going to care, you know, for my family or my next door neighbour or my friend as much as a person who I've never met who lives in a completely different culture across the other sides of the world is very difficult. They call it cosmopolitanism, where, you know, we're all meant to share the same concern for all of us. Well, that's great, and Jesus tried to do it, and all the great leaders have tried to do it, but you know, it's never really worked. And so I think that what we need to move towards, a guy called Derek Wall, who's an international spokesperson for the Green Party, did some really interesting work on, there was the idea of, back in the, again, around this time, late 60s, it was a right-wing idea by a guy called Roger Hardin, and I'm sure your listeners and yourselves are familiar with it, the tragedy of the commons. Anything held in common will inevitably be wrecked by the people who have access to those commons, because they'll just use it for their own purpose and think, well, that person's going to overgraze their cattle on it, so I might as well do that same as mine and reap as much benefit as I can before it's destroyed. So this tragedy of the commons is a very right-wing idea. It's people are just all out for what they can get and are enemies of each other. But actually, when you sort of do the research, you look at old, you know, historic societies, etc., people don't do that. You know, I mean, we came in, you know, the, sort of this system emerged after what, however many, a million years of humanity. People were obviously well able to organize themselves in a sustainable manner for the vast majority of human history. And they haven't, that was never done on the global scale. That's done at the scale of, you know, that tribe, that community or whatever, but not at the global scale. That's inherently unnatural. And the only way anything can work at the global scale is to surrender power to people who have had the privilege of the education, the upbringing, the background, to be able to capture those reins of power. And once they've got them, they will inevitably use them to replicate the power and privileges of themselves, their family, and their own class. So it's a real, you know, I think, and so that 2C is really at the root of the problem. That's what, for me, is always like, you know, taking a small axe to a big tree. If you get that 2C out of the way, then you can really break open the debate and the conversation. So that, for me, is where I think the democratic governance comes from. If it's a globalized problem, reliant on globalized institutions, then you're just, you know, the power over those institutions, control over the debate, control over the responses to the problem will always be in the hands of the few to the detriment of the many. So there's no way I can see of solving this through the current power and democratic or political structures that are currently trying to respond to this issue.
That's an excellent point, and you brought up science and how we can't really predict what the maximum temperature will be that will be problematic. David Spratt pointed out by a video in October 2014 that half a degree Celsius was a more reasonable target. That's been in the rearview mirror for a long time. Speaking of democracy and its pursuit, what do you know about the climate refugee crisis, particularly from Syria? Have you noticed any local impacts from that crisis that's going on?
Yeah, well, certainly within the UK, I have, you know, and that's been, it's a bit of a, you know, struck me as sort of slightly muddy waters. In one sense, you've seen, and this sort of comes back to what I was saying previously about the work I've been doing with, groups of the public, and you see these good values coming forth from people about, what matters to them, kindness, caring, honesty, integrity, etc., etc. And within the UK, there has been an outpouring, really, of, let the refugees in. People open up their houses to the refugees, and really, quite an outpouring of great human values and acceptance of that these are human beings like ourselves suffering. However, how did that get into the public sphere? Well, there was a picture, I don't know if it's the same in the US, of a poor child, a young child about 2 or 3 years old who had drowned trying to get escape from Syria. Now, in actual fact, as far as I was concerned, that photo, it was being replicated in all the right-wing media who never cared, couldn't care two hoots about people the other side of the world. But what it was, it then kicked off the debate about, well, we need to bomb Syria to prevent any more suffering like this happening again. The reason why, those images were brought to the fore of the media and triggered, that natural, intrinsic, instinctive response of humans to want to care for other people was, I think, a bit suspicious for me. But nonetheless, there has been an outpouring. But again, and another thing I've sort of seen is, people saying, well, the Syria thing is in part due to climate change. That may or may not be true, I don't know. But again, it just speaks to a certain sense of a political naivety that, really, for me, what has been driving that is imperial ambitions and other sort of geopolitical drivers. And to sort of, so I think it'd be a much more interesting avenue to take those sort of debates down rather than say, well, it's just, climate change doing it. There's a lot more to it than that, but it's interrelated about how politics and power are, expressed and actioned in the world.
Excellent. We have run out of time. Mike Sleeve and I were joined today by Dr. Chris Shaw, Chris is Visiting Fellow in the field of science and policy research at the University of Sussex. Thanks very much, Chris Shaw, for joining us on Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you very much, Guy. It's been a real pleasure. And once again, thank you for the chance to speak to you and take up some of your time. Much appreciated. Great privilege for me.
Thanks, Chris.
Pleasure is all ours, Chris. Mike has a statement from the Doomer of the Week. Mike, tell us who that is and what they have to say.
All right. Doomer of the Week is Kevin Hester for posting the following in Near-Term Extinction Love Group. Gaia has recently done a cost-benefit analysis on human beings and decided that they are an unnecessary liability to Gaia, Inc., and will be liquidated within a 10-year period. While Gaia accepts this will be taken as bad news by the species, this decision has been taken in greater interest of the entire ecosystem, and it has been determined that losing this one disruptive, vengeful, toxic, full-of-themselves species for the benefit of the whole is a good investment. The decision was taken democratically, and it must be noted that the vote was uncontested with 100% of the votes for extinction, and that humans had failed to bother to vote for themselves as they were too busy at the time raping and looting. Observations of the species since the vote was taken have shown no discernible change in behavior, and their loss will always be remembered by the firestorm of 430-odd nuclear meltdowns and 1,200 spent fuel pool fires. Extinction date will be recorded somewhere in the 2020s as some of the privileged elites managed to hang on a few years in their exclusive prison cells deep within mountains until their electricians and plumbers expired. It was written on the tombstone that humans knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. Carpe diem. Very well put. And that's Kevin Hester, Doomer of the Week. And Guy, you have something for us, a statement?
Yes, I want to read again my response, my initial response to Dave from Chicago. Dave called in with a request last week. He wanted a short paragraph he could memorize that would tell people about abrupt climate change because, like many of us, he has been asked the question, what's going on in the world of climate change? And he wants to provide a short explanation that is rooted in reality and that goes beyond the linear, slow climate change that most of us are familiar with. So I have prepared this statement. I welcome your feedback, and we'll post this on the two groups on Facebook. And if I am energetic enough, I'll get it on the blog today, too.
Woo-hoo.
We are of abrupt climate change, which will soon obliterate habitat on this planet for our species. This event has precedence in Earth's history, and it's irreversible at time frames that matter for humans. Civilization is a heat engine, and the planet is about to overheat. Our species, like all others, will go extinct. It's later than you think. I'm not suggesting we give up in the face of certain death. I am, however, indicating that birth is a sexually transmitted disease that is lethal in every case. We all die. What matters now is how we choose to live. That's always been the case, although we often lose track of the urgency.
Hello?
So, Mike, why don't you take it away? Why don't you wrap it up for us as we bring it there?
Okay, I didn't know if I lost you there for a second or what. All right, so folks, that wraps it up about this week. Our thanks to Dr. Chris Shaw for his words of wisdom. And make sure to like our Facebook page on Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.fm. And feel free to post some questions and make those phone calls in when we take calls. And continue to follow Guy's blog on GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. We'll interview Jania Donaldson of Peak Moment TV. And if you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.fm and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to Afrizin for his work. And until next time, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Guy...
Nature bats last.
Right on.
She bats last and she's coming.